morning, and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. Today is a day that we spend once a year to commemorate the life and the work and the efforts of one Madame Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, or HPB, as we affectionately refer to her. And we will have a brief talk about her life and times, followed by readings in the Bhagavad Gita, The Light of Asia, and The Voice of the Silence, as she asked if we were to remember her on an occasion. Those are three books that she held particular reverence for. And then there will be a talk about theosophy. So Madame Blavatsky, HPB, is known as the modern-day messenger of the theosophical movement. Well, why so? Because the doctrines that she taught, which were not her teachings, but which she brought forward to the people of her time, and which descends to us as well, those teachings would upset the religious orthodoxy of the time. They would upset the materialistic scientists, academic philosophers, and psychics and charlatans of every stripe. These teachings, why so? It's because they were a threat to the entrenched thought of the day. And yet, they are universal ideas, ideas that have been around since the dawn of man. False ideas had continued to linger after 15 centuries of the Dark Ages, and HBB arriving on the scene was one who had the power and the courage to upset the apple cart. She brought with her ideas that were thought to be long drowned with the continent of Atlantis, long buried under the crumbling temples of ancient antiquity, or long burned with the Alexandrian Library. Well, let's take a look at her life, and we can look at it in three phases. The first phase would be her childhood and early development, and then there was a period of study and travel, which lasted for many years, and then finally her public work, the writings, the books, the founding of the Theosophical movement. The young Helena, Mademoiselle Helena, was born in Ekaterinoslav in the evening of July 30th and 31st at about midnight, 1831, in what was then in Russia, in the Russian world, was a slightly different calendar, but at the time it was the evening of July 30th and 31st. And this, according to Russian folklore, was a special evening reserved, perhaps just for the birth of mystics. Perhaps there was some echo of maybe a modern-day Halloween, but there was something mystical about it. She was born on this evening. And so from the first, there were folks around her who were expecting from her somewhat of an unconventional life. This young child is from two very powerful family lines. Her father is Colonel Peter von Hahn, who was a colonel in the Tsar's regiment. His father was General Alexis Hahn von Rautenstern, who was a descendant of Count Rautenstern, who was known in Russia to be an infamous great crusader. HPB's mother, her mother was from a long line of powerful titles. In particular, her mother was known as a journalist. In her day, we're talking late 1700s, early 1800s, a journalist, a writer for women's rights in Russia. So a character of that strength to raise a child apparently was suited to be the mother of HPB, an interesting combination. Perhaps the notable, however, of her mother's family line was one known as the Grand Duke Rorik, who, 1,000 years earlier, is known to be actually the first leader of what is now known to be Mother Russia. So we find in the writings of Mr. Judge that HPB was born under the power of the Holy Tsar. As true as that statement is, she was also born at a time when there was, at a time of coffins and desolation because Eastern Europe was under the grip of a cholera epidemic. So among the funerals and the coffins that were the fact in that day, it was decided that Helena, being born prematurely, might be particularly susceptible to this disease. And it was decided that she's to be baptized immediately, lest she die with the stain of original sin on her soul. So in particular, at the baptismal ceremony, at the ritual the day after she was born, which was held by the Greek Catholic priest, together with all the members of her extended family, her family is standing there, as is traditional. Everyone had a taper, a candle. In that part of the baptismal ceremony where the participants are invited to denounce the evil one and symbolically spit 3 times, as this is going on, the robes of the priest surprisingly go up in flames. Several people were more or less severely burned, and it seems perhaps ominous, it seems a foreshadow, perhaps a sign yet to come in the life of Madame Blavatsky. Having reflected on what happened, it was determined that the baby's child age aunt was tired, was sitting behind the group. She had the candle a little too close to the priest's robes, and that's what caused the flames. Now, throughout her childhood, our young Helena is generally known to be the wonder of her friends and the terror of the simpler serfs. Why? Because of her metaphysical powers. Mostly, really, not under her control. She had the ability, though, to look someone in the eye and tell them what the date of their death would be. So this made her the center of the party, so to speak, whenever folks were around. We have a curious story of the child at a time when she was living in her grandparents' mansion. There was a curious painting hung high on a wall, obscured by a curtain, and Helena wanted to pull that curtain back to expose the painting. So to do so, she built a mountain of furniture, stacking one table on another and a chair on top of that, as perhaps we've all done at one time or another. And while up high, with one hand bracing the dusty wall to balance her weight and the other reaching to move the curtain, of course this mountain of furniture collapses. And the next moment, all she knows is she woke up. And the furniture was all back in its place as though it had never been moved. So she wondered if she hadn't dreamt what she had done. Upon looking up, she says that she saw that the curtain was pulled back and that her small handprint in the dust on the wall was in clear view. She didn't have an explanation for this. That's the first of a number of events where it seems that there's a protective atmosphere among Helena in her early childhood. In her teen years, we're told that Helena never really had a sense of conventionality, so to speak, as would be somewhat appropriate for a royal young lady as she, because in a day when gentle ladies of her time would ride a horse side saddle, Helena could be found riding astride on any of the horses in her father's regiment. She spent time in the field with her father and his soldiers. Her soldiers collectively were like one big protective brotherhood for Helena and her sister, who were always inseparable. But there is this one account when she was riding a horse in the field and the soldiers see her galloping along at a point when she loses her balance, falls from the horse, her foot caught in the stirrup, and yet her body seemed to actually float along the ground because the horse had never broken its stride. Until the horse came to a stop, it seemed her body was gently placed on the ground and she was unharmed. As a young teenager, the young Mademoiselle spent time in Paris and London with her father, some segment of her early teen years, where she studied, where she made progress in music. Eventually, she would spend time actually earning her living as, or making money, we would say, maybe that's a better word, as a concert pianist. So she made quite some progress in music. But on her return, now fast forward, she's 17 years old. She's had this governess all her childhood. She has a particular relationship with the governess who knows how to manage her or not, we could say. And at some point, the governess tells her, really, you know, you need to start acting like a lady or you're never going to attract a man of any stock. You're never going to get a good husband. Perhaps taking offense to this or accepting it as a dare, the governess, point in fact, told her, not even this old man down the street, General Blavatsky, would consider you for his wife. So taking that as the dare, our teenager Helena positions herself socially with this gentleman down the street, three times her age, a retired general in the army, and she does so with the intention to extract a proposal from him, and she gets it, just to spite her governess. Well, unfortunately for Helena, and much to her chagrin, she is socially bound to marry him because of the customs of the time. She accepted the proposal. Perhaps she could have gotten out of it had she gotten the weight of her family to bear down on the issue, but her family wouldn't because they decided, really, it's time to get her married. She needs to calm down. So the wedding happens. She's 17 years old. She's living in this mansion with this retired three-star general. Three tempestuous, chaste months go by in which he's already had to put guards on her to stop her from running away, which is not going to work for you know who. So she, at one night, she had enough. She gathered her belongings. She gives the guards the slip and jumps a horse and gallops away, never to be seen by General Blavatsky again. Thus begins her second phase of her life, that phase of travel and study in certain special private ways. So off she goes, and she goes through India, Eastern Europe, parts of Africa. She travels across the United States on wagon train. She spends time in Canada, New Orleans, Central and South America, in particular attracted to the colossal monuments such as those found in Mexico and Peru, all the while studying the traditions, the legends of the indigenous cultures, and in cultures and peoples who she had visited, it is said that she, when present, and this is documented for some. We don't know it's for all, but when present, she could speak the language of the people with whom she sat. She couldn't speak the language before she got there. She couldn't speak the language after she left. But when present, she could speak the language of the people. Now, it must be said here that around 1851, she's in London. She's 20 years old and sees from, so to speak, from afar, a group from East India who are present in London for a larger function conducted by Queen Victoria, and recognizes among this group of men this one individual who, in her childhood dreams, she had repetitive dreams and recognized him in the physical. When she sees him, he recognized her, makes a mild gesture indicating to her, keep it to yourself for now. And shortly thereafter, because there was a group, shortly thereafter, they meet in the physical, they have their conversation, and from this point forward, we understand that Madame Blavatsky would thenceforth refer to him as a master. By 1858, so this is years later, after her travels, HPB returns home to Russia, having been worried that if she returns home, would the general exact his due rights and claim his marriage rights on her, but actually he wrote a letter to the family because they said there was concern, and he gave his word in writing that he would have nothing to do with her. She can come back and do as she saw fit. So she returns home at a time for a while where her metaphysical talents were far beyond what they ever were. But this is at a time when she's learning to gain control over them. The idea being that really she would no longer use her metaphysical phenomena or talents simply for the purpose of curiosity, answering curiosity, but only for learning or teaching. Having spent some time there for a short time there, she travels on through Greece, through India, Egypt, and Tibet. Throughout these travels, through these civilizations, these cultures, she's studying the philosophies, their religions, the ancient teachings of these Eastern nations. It's at this time in her life where she learns of the sages of the East, where she's learning philosophy and religion, both ancient and modern, and synthesizing them. It's a time when she learns of the fraternity of perfected beings who stand watch over humanity, who preserve the accumulated wisdom of all civilizations, and who from time to time send a messenger back with a portion of that wisdom that humanity is ready for. By 1871, at the age of 40, HPB is landed in New York. She joins the spiritualist societies with the specific purpose of teaching spiritualists the truth about what they're doing, the truth about the necromancy that they're practicing. Her intention is to teach them the dangers of necromancy and the dangers of the abuse of psychic powers. She's not received well by this group. By 1874, Madame Blavatsky has met the co-founder, William Q. Judge. And of this, he writes his first meeting. This is what he writes of his first meeting with her. He says, "It was her eye that attracted me, the eye of one whom I must have known in lives long passed away. Not as a questioner of philosophies did I come before her, not as one groping in the dark for lights that schools and fanciful theories had obscured, but As one, I was wandering through the corridors of life. I was seeking the friends who could show where the designs of the work had been hidden. And true to the call, she responded, revealing the plans once again. Speaking no words to explain, she simply pointed them out and went on with the task. It was as if the evening before we had parted, leaving yet to be done some detail of a task taken up with one common end. It was teacher and pupil, older brother and younger, both bent on one single end, but she, with the power and the wisdom that belong but to lions and sages. So, from the first, I felt safe. The third and final phase of that incarnation of Madame Blavatsky is her public life, that of her public writings, her books, founding the Theosophical Movement. This phase is heralded on November of 1875 with the founding of the Theosophical Society, co-founded by HPB, William Q. Judge, Henry Steele Olcott, and others. By 1878, HPB publishes Isis Unveiled, which is known as the master key to the mysteries of ancient and modern science and religion. Although the New York papers of the day hailed this book as a work of immense research, anyone who was a witness to the production of that book could testify that Madame Blavatsky wrote that book straight out of hand, 1,500 pages with no library and no notes from reading previously done. By December of that same year, HPB has moved to India. She's founding theosophical branches there. In Bombay, it's said by Hindus in Bombay that Madame Blavatsky is teaching Indians insights into their philosophy, the keys to which have either been lost or have been held back by the Brahmins from the people. Incidentally, some decades later, as a side note, in his autobiography, Mr. Gandhi would mention his membership in Madame Blavatsky's London Theosophical Lodge. Mr. Gandhi had been invited by two Theosophists, brothers, to study the Bhagavad Gita. Now, this is something that Mr. Gandhi had never been involved with. He was not raised in a religious way. He was in his 20s. He was in London to go to school. He was more interested in the fashion and the social life than Indian philosophy. But having taken up the study of the Bhagavad Gita with these two Theosophists, he was then presented with the book, HPB's book, The Key to Theosophy, by Madame Blavatsky, whom he sat with. This inspired him, he says, to begin his own study of the philosophy of his ancestors. So who can imagine the effect that his efforts have had on the hundreds of millions of Asians since, on the so many millions of South Africans since, because he went directly from London, being a member of the Theosophical Society, back to India for several years, on to do work in South America, and had an effect on other great leaders in the world, such as Nelson Mandela, following his tradition of Ahimsa, such as Martin Luther King, following his tradition of Ahimsa. And Martin Luther King was emulated by a Vietnamese Buddhist monk, Thich Nhat Hanh, who was actually nominated for a Nobel Prize by Dr. King for his work in Ahimsa during a period in the early 60s with the Vietnam Civil War that was going on, and he continued it on into the 70s. So, Back to HPB. By 1887, HPB is back in London after her stay in India. She founds the magazine Lucifer. She's continuously writing during her waning years. This is toward the end of her life. Continuing her public work, she publishes The Secret Doctrine in 1888. The Secret Doctrine has a subtitle, The Synthesis of Science, Religion, and Philosophy. Comes in two volumes, Cosmology and Anthropology, which are bound as one book. This also actually is fully referenced and footnoted, 1,500 pages written in similar fashion to Isis Unveiled, straight out of hand by Madame Blavatsky. Also in 1889, this Voice of the Silence is translated by her, annotated, and published. Finally, then of course there's also the Key to Theosophy. Now the Key to Theosophy, which we study here regularly, is a book that's written in question and answer format. It's an exposition on the ethics and philosophy of theosophy. Finally, HPB's Theosophical Glossary is published. She wrote it in large part, which simply is a book that explains theosophical names, places, and terms, written in large part by her, but finished for us by her companions posthumously in 1892. HPB passed away on May 8, 1891. Shortly before her death, she's known to have awakened from her illness and delivered the following words to her students. Keep the link unbroken. Do not let my last incarnation be a failure. So we could say, if there were such a thing as a miracle, which from a theosophic perspective is wishful thinking. But a lot of people attribute somewhat miracles to the work of HPB's life, and she would argue there's no such thing as a miracle. However, we think perhaps HPB's greatest works, her truest miracles, are her books. Her books. HPB's books are the hallmark of her genius. They are, we're not talking about metaphysical phenomena, we're not talking about precipitating teacups out of the air, but her books are the vehicles of the ancient wisdom religion, an ancient system of universal thought that has been transmitted, passed down, descended from race to race, from people to people, from age to age, and really from friend to friend. And it's done so, the truths of her tradition, the truths of this philosophy are passed on only by those who freely choose to do it, who freely choose to do the work, by those who freely choose to follow the lines laid down by HPB, the founder of the Theosophical movement. It's done by those who freely choose to keep the link unbroken.
First reading are excerpts from The Voice of the Silence. Of teachers there are many. The master soul is one, Alaya, the universal soul. Live in that master and its ray in thee. Live in thy fellows as they live in it. Before thou standest on the threshold of the path, before thou crossest the foremost gate, thou hast to merge the two into the one, and sacrifice the personal to self impersonal, and thus destroy the path between the two on Tuscarana. Thou hast to be prepared to answer Dharma, the stern law, whose voice will ask thee at thy initial step, hast thou complied with all the rules, O thou of lofty hopes? Hast thou attuned thy heart and mind to the great mind and heart of all mankind? For as the sacred river's roaring voice, whereby all nature sounds are echoed back, so must the heart of him who in the stream would enter thrill in response to every sigh and thought of all that lives and breathes. Remember, thou that fightest for man's liberation, each failure is success, and each sincere attempt wins its reward in time. The holy germs that sprout and grow unseen in the disciple's soul, their stalks wax strong at each new trial. They bend like reeds but never break, nor can they e'er be lost. But when the hour has struck, they blossom forth. The seeds of wisdom cannot sprout and grow in airless space. To live and reap experience, the mind needs breadth and depth and points to draw it towards the diamond soul. Seek not those points in Maya's realm, but soar beyond illusions. Search the eternal and the changeless sight, mistrusting fancy's false suggestions. For mind is like a mirror, it gathers dust while it reflects. It needs the gentle breezes of soul wisdom to brush away the dust of our illusions. Seek, O beginner, to blend thy mind and soul. The Dharma of the eye is the embodiment of the external and the non-existing. The Dharma of the heart is the embodiment of Bodhi, the permanent and everlasting.
These are excerpts from the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna and Krishna. Vatokasava is the description of that wise and devoted man who is fixed in contemplation and confirmed in spiritual knowledge. Does he move and act like other men? A man is said to be confirmed in spiritual knowledge when he forsaketh every desire which entered into his heart, and of himself is happy and content in the self, through the self. His mind is undisturbed in adversity. He is happy and contented in prosperity, and he is a stranger to anxiety, fear, and anger. True wisdom of a spiritual kind is freedom from self-esteem, hypocrisy, and injury to others. It is patience, sincerity, respect for spiritual instructors, purity, firmness, self-restraint, dispassion for objects of sense, freedom from pride, and then meditation upon birth, death, decay, sickness, and error. It is an exemption from self-identifying attachment for children, wife, and household, and a constant, unwavering steadiness of heart upon the arrival of every event, whether favorable or unfavorable. It is a resolute continuance in the study of Adhyatma, the superior spirit, and a meditation upon the end of the acquirement of a knowledge of truth. This is called wisdom or spiritual knowledge. Fearlessness, sincerity, assiduity in devotion, generosity, self-restraint, piety, and almsgivings. Study, mortification and rectitude, harmlessness, veracity, and freedom from anger, resignation, equanimity, and not speaking of the faults of others. Universal compassion, modesty, and mildness. Patience, power, fortitude, and purity. Discretion, dignity, unrevengefulness, and freedom from conceit. These are the marks of him whose virtues are of a godlike character. What is night to those who are unenlightened is as day to his gaze. What seems as day is known to him as night, the night of ignorance. Such is the self-governed sage.
These are excerpts from The Light of Asia. Pray not, the darkness will not brighten. Ask not from the silence, for it cannot speak. Vex not your mournful minds with pious pains. Ah, brothers, sisters, seek not from the helpless gods by gift and hymn, nor bribe with blood, nor feed with fruit and cakes. Within yourself, deliverance must be sought. Each man his prison makes. Who toiled a slave may come anew a prince, for gentle worthiness and merit won. Who rules a king may wander earth in rags for things done and undone. Higher than Indra's ye may lift your lot and sing it lower than the worm or gnat. The end of many myriads lives is this, the end of myriads that. Only while turns this wheel invisible, no pause, no peace, no staying place can be. Who mounts will fall, who falls may mount, and the spokes go round incessantly. If ye lay bound upon the wheel of change, and no way of breaking from that chain, the heart of boundless being is a cause, the soul of things, fell pain. Ye are not bound. The soul of things is sweet. The heart of being is celestial rest. Stronger than woe is will. That which was good doth pass to better best. I, Bood, who wept with all my brother's tears, whose heart was broken by a whole world's woe, laugh, and I am glad, for there is liberty. Ho ye who suffer, know ye suffer from yourselves. None else compels, none other holds ye that you live and die, and whirl upon the wheel, and hug and kiss its spokes of agony, its tires of tears, its nave of nothingness. Behold, I show you truth. Lower than hell, higher than heaven, outside the utmost stars, farther than Brahm doth dwell, before beginning and without an end, as space eternal, as surety sure, is fixed a power divine, which moves to good, only its laws endure.
On the first anniversary of the celebration of the death, or the commemoration of HPB's life, we read those things which he had wished for. But what happened was, in the gardens of Adyar, the lotus blossoms were bloomed profusely. So the following year, from that day forth, it was called White Lotus Day. Mr. Alcott is the one who initiated that. But what is it that we can say about this woman? We just heard a description of a physical being, just like us, who is traipsing through life with some intentness in some direction. And then we look at the life that was hers. She could have lived a very frivolous life, if she so wished. But she didn't. So there's some kind of gratitude that we feel for a person who sacrificed their entire life for truth. And it's like she sacrificed her life to give us life. Because we live in the world of unreality. It's this world that is transitory and constantly changing. It's the world that we've made. And we find HPB in the world saying that, well, yes, we made all of this. But we can make better, with better ideas. Ideas that are ancient and eternal. They're the foundation with an understanding of them, the world unfolds to us, or this chemistry, or this philosophy, this religious presentation that is called theosophy, is a blending of all of that. When HPB first arrived here, well, we first started the theosophical movement officially in 1875, she was told, this is how she presents it, to start writing. And she didn't know why or what for. But she said, much later, after she had put it aside, and she was asked again to take it up, and it became Isis Unveiled. So, we are talking about powers of man, powers that we have, but because we haven't trained our mind and our hearts, we're not able to access it. So concentration, or one-pointedness, is how things are accomplished. So if we had one-pointedness, but with the reality that the world is septenary, I'm septenary. There's seven states of consciousness. There's much more beyond what I see as this body. There's a whole other world. There's a whole other world. And that world is called, we call, once you begin to look at it, that is reality. This other transitory world is a make-believe world that we have made up collectively. The only prison that we are in is in our mind. We're locked in our minds with our tendency to be engulfed by the age. And it's the age of great materialism, where there is a great struggle for spiritual perception. There is a great struggle. No one came here easily. Well, we have gratitude to this woman who gave up her life, literally gave it up, to pass on these teachings. And how better could you do it than writing them down? It's not hearsay. You have the truth. And she said that it was my duty to wake these folks up. They're sleeping. No one knows how to think anymore. And we know thinking is something that we are told that we can develop through concentration and meditation. It is no secret. That's what HPB said. The exoteric aspect of this world is not important. It's the esoteric aspect. And that's the reality that we are connected. We are a unit. We are electromagnetic beings. We're in contact with everyone. And we have this world around us that is filled with electricity, filled with magnetism. And we know because through our life, we've attracted some things to us that perhaps we didn't want. HBB states that we are the gods. We have to look within, not outside of oneself. We are responsible. We can make a choice, and we're being presented with that choice now, long before others. We're having the opportunity to know what these truths are. But HPV says, this is only for those who want it. Many are called, but few are chosen. There are those beings who have sacrificed their lives and continue to do so on this journey through life, through many incarnations. So why are we concentrating so hard on this incarnation? What about our soul life that is eternal? Do we pay attention to that? If we are firmly convinced that karma and reincarnation are a fact in nature, we are ruled by that. We are ruled by our thought, word, and deed. That is our creating and is our creative aspect. We are creative. What is more creative than universal brotherhood? Being a fact. And if you look at nature, you see that. You see destruction, but you see an overwhelming communication going on and a harmony of working together. You know, all the kingdoms, plant kingdom and mineral kingdom, plant, animal, and this human kingdom. But here's where the big boogie boo comes in, because we have a choice. And what is so strong today? Our desires. We are in that age of materialism. Our desires are our test. Are we willing to sacrifice for the greater good? Are we? Are we willing to sacrifice our appetites to our higher good, our study, our living a life in harmony? These are ideas. These are ideas. But these ideas materialize, especially when you have many that associate with these same ideas. And there are many. They don't call it theosophy, but it has universal brotherhood in its roots. And you can find that all over the world in all religions. It's just a dogma and the silly following without thinking. And for many of us, that's what got us into these rooms, because we thought about these things too much and they didn't make sense. We thought about many things. These ideas are eternal, boundless, and immutable. They've existed for all times. And there is no outside being. There is a being-us that sustains the universe, that is space, infinite, and unchanged by our presence. It always exists. We need to expand the mind in abstract ways and need to think and become responsible for the words and the ideas that we express. If one can change your heart, if you can change your heart, HPB says you can change your life. Do not live for oneself, but live for others, as she did. There's many things that can be said about HPB. But she will always say that all this work that I did not do it alone. I had help. And these were these elder brothers. And there were two that were mentioned. And they compiled the information and presented it in the astral life, light, so that HPB could read it. It's not an unknown phenomenon. Magicians have been doing it for the longest of time. We have to expand our mind to consider other ideas, that we are not this physical body. We are dynamic. And we are creators of our own destiny. And HPB says, yes, there are those beings that have lived before, just as we have, and developed their natures and became perfected. But at one point, they had to make a choice. Should I go on to nirvana, to bliss? I've earned it. Or should I stay back and help poor suffering humanity? Well, these are called her Manikayas. These were her teachers. She was a pupil of them. Theosophists are those same pupils. Deep within all of this, you must find your truth. HPB is a great friend, for she points out many different ways of looking at this philosophy. But the heart is shown through the light of Asia and the Bhagavad Gita. The path is shown. You are the pilgrim, and it's the choices you make to live in the eternal or live in the transitory. She pointed the way. She said, this is how we're not alone. We must reach up. They cannot come. The age is too material, too heavy. So you know the reality. What do you do about it? What do you do about it? Well, HPB, Mr. Judd says, it's a contest of smiles. All right? Find your joy. Find your joy in your love of life and the association with others. But these truths will give you that glow or that warmth that you need. It will light up your heart. For compassion is the greatest of all virtues. Well, we come to an end, but not really. We continue this study every week, year in and year out. And we invite everyone to come. Our doors are open. These ideas are free. There is nothing charged for them. HPB says she would never take a penny for the words that she has written about this philosophy. And she never did. Never, nigh a penny. She struggled by doing writing for magazines in Russia and so forth. But I'd like to remind you that everything with this lodge to sustain these ideas in the public is an effort of community. Everyone is invited to become part of that community. And you can do that through voluntary service of time, action, service, or money. There are many ways that you can help, and maybe just by talking and contributing your feelings, they would help. We always like other human beings to come in and talk to us. So, in memory of H.P. Blavatsky, we hope you good fortune and a bright theosophical future. Meeting adjourned. Good job. Very good reading. Charlie's